right? And light-skinned people when they come here. So, you know, before the Irish came here, they weren't, the term white didn't make any sense to them, right? Before the Italians came here, the term white, it didn't really make any sense to them. Before Russian Jews, like my great-grandfather came here, we weren't white, we were whatever we were. We were Russian, Irish, Scottish, German, whatever. But the term white is a term of art developed in this nation to get all those European people, no matter how poor they were, in the same place against people who were of color as a way to divide and conquer and to keep them on the side of the angels, so to speak, those with power and money. And so because Central European Slavic peoples don't have the same level of immigration historically to the United States as Western Europeans, Northern Europeans, and even Eastern Europeans from Russia, they haven't had the same opportunity to become white so we can bomb them with impunity and not really view them as like ourselves. But notice in World War II, I would make the argument, and I can't prove it, but I think it's a fairly decent analysis if you looked at what led up to our involvement in that war. We didn't care what Germany was doing for 8 years. Not only did we not care, economically we were collaborating with the Nazis. Some of our biggest companies were in bed with the Nazis, did not care what they did to Jews, did not care what they did to gypsies, did not care what they did to homosexuals, didn't care what they did to anybody, until they declared war on us in the wake of Pearl Harbor. And then, of course, well, if a nation declares war on you, you know, you sort of got to go to war. You got to keep up appearances at the very least. And so we end up bombing Germany, to be sure, right? We firebomb parts of their country. We go to war against them. But we waited till the very last moment. And in this country, of course, we did not treat those of German descent the same way we did those of Japanese descent. So even there, there was this differential level of treatment. Our history of militarism is one that is overtly racist, and right now, we would not be bombing Dublin if this had been an IRA action. We find it far easier. What would we do if it was the IRA or Protestant militants opposed to the IRA? What would we do? We would go search for the perpetrators. We would try and find the individuals actually involved, and we'd arrest them. And that's what we ought to be doing here, but it's not what we're doing here. We are indiscriminately talking about bombing people and then trying to justify it by making it seem like we really don't, you know, dislike these people, we love them, that's why we're dropping food to them. We're dropping it in minefields so that to pick it up, you got to blow yourself up first, but, you know, that's okay, and it'll make sure that, you know, those folks who get some of our food rations, why they will have a total, you know, we keep saying things like, what other nation in the history of the world has both bombed and fed at the same time? Well, not many, but that's because most other nations recognize the utter hypocrisy of doing that. And most other people... And it's obviously absurd. I mean, you know, put yourself in Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. Now, do you really think that the folks who were bombed to oblivion in Pearl Harbor would have thought better of the bombing if the Japanese had made a second run and dropped sushi and edamame on the boats? I doubt seriously that we would have thought that was impressive or that we would have said, well, we won't go to war now because, you know, you fed us after you bombed us. But we somehow, this arrogance, this sort of cultural arrogance, I don't know where I got off on that tangent, but the reality is that that we have to understand the functionality of this, and we have to understand the way it affects all of our conditioning so that we respond. I mean, when was the last time that Arab peoples in this country, or Muslims of whatever ethnic or national background, were portrayed in the media in any way other than this sort of negative way that they're being portrayed right now? You know, when was the last time you saw a story about Arab peoples or Muslims that was, you know, just going and asking them, well, you know, what do you think about the parks in your community or the schools in your community or daycare or healthcare? You know, treating them like any other member of the society. You can go to Dearborn, Michigan, right? The largest concentration of Arab Americans, the largest concentration of Arabs outside of what we generally consider the Arab world. And you don't see the Detroit newspapers going into that community regularly to talk about those people's dreams and aspirations and everyday lives. But if something happens, a terrorist incident takes place, then all of a sudden, what happens? Well, now we have stories. Now, maybe the stories at their best are the stories where, what, the reporter goes in and tries to find some people in the community that can condemn it. And, of course, it's not hard to find because almost everyone will. So you go in, you find people who say, my God, this was a terrible thing. It's completely against the foundational principles of Islam, etc. But notice that even those stories are still being put out there through the lens of terrorism. So that even at their best, this community's voice is only heard when a terrorist incident happens, which reinforces the mentality that these people are only relevant when something horrible has happened, committed by people who look a lot like them. And so even at their best, I don't have to really view them as fundamentally equal and human to me. They're still only relevant. They only show up on my radar screen when something awful has taken place, right? So that kind of conditioning affects us all. How do we respond to that? Well, first, let us be very clear. We have to make an understanding of the structural components of racism central to our analysis, So much of liberal anti-racism is not about that. It is about fighting individual racist or attitudinal bias, right? Fighting the Klan, fighting neo-Nazis, and fighting skinheads. None of that is bad work, by the way. It's all good. But let us be clear where those people come from, because those are symptoms of a larger issue. They are not the problem. Why would a person come to the conclusion that people of color were less human than themselves and therefore could be eradicated at will or run out of the country or beaten in the form of a hate crime? What would give them that impression? Again, I would suggest to you that if our society, through its own inequity and the treatment of people of color, guarantees that they are disproportionately on the bottom of the labor market, the bottom of the educational system, the bottom of the housing market, and disproportionately being locked up, the impression that that gives to people is precisely that those people are less than human. So why would we be surprised that some people would take that to an extreme and then decide that, well, you know, if our society knows that these people are the dangerous ones and can lock them up, then by God, I'm going to stop them from moving into my neighborhood. I'm going to take it into my own hands, right? So in other words, even those who are overt haters, even those who are the bigots, the Klan, the Nazis, the skinheads, they get this not because Matt Hale sat them down and talked to them about the World Church of the Creator and convinced them, you know, that Jews were the, you know, the devil and black people were subhuman. I mean, something happened before that. Because if our society was in fact a society of equity where institutional racism did not determine who was in jail and who wasn't, who ran the companies and who worked for them at low wages, who was in the best schools and who was in the worst schools, people like Matt Hale would be anachronisms, right? Their rap would have no resonance with anybody. Their shtick would not stick because they would be saying things that people would know were just absolutely absurd. They would think, you know, if Matt Hale were to come out and say, well, black people are inherently criminal, just look at who's in the jails. Well, that only works because of who is in the jails, right? If somebody gets up and says black and Latino people are lazy, they don't want to work as hard, they can only say that because they can point to the unemployment numbers and then play upon this prejudice and this stereotype of why a person's out of work. If, in fact, the unemployment numbers, the labor market figures, the educational housing numbers, and the justice system numbers were equitable, which won't happen as long as institutional racism still exists in those institutions, then his kind of analysis wouldn't make any sense. He'd find no converts. He would find no people to go into the streets with him, let alone to commit hate crimes, because it would just be so obviously absurd. The reason people come to that point is because the system has conditioned them to that. And if we're going to address that overt racism, if we're going to fight the Klan, fight Nazis, fight skinheads, we must understand that those are people created by the system, not merely by parents that didn't treat them well. Because that's what liberals say. They say you have to be taught how to hate, yes, but you're not only taught how to hate by your parents. The idea that somehow your parents have sit you down and tell you, you know, stay away from black people, stay away from Latinos, stay away from those people. Those, you know, some parents do that, but the reality is even if they don't, the system, the society gives you these messages in very subtle form and sometimes not so subtle and reinforces them so that you could have, you know, parents who were overtly anti-racist, but unless you're getting the kind of systemic counter-analysis to deal with that institutional inequity, it's very possible for some lazy minds to fall into that and then to become members of these entities and organizations. So let us keep that in mind. Secondly, we have to recognize that whatever social justice work we are involved in has to have an anti-racism analysis as part of it. Now, this is very important. I don't expect every person in this room or in any gathering where I go to make racism itself sort of their key issue, which is what I do. It just happens to be what moves me, but I'm involved in other movements and I realize all these other battles are also critical, right? Gender equity movements for the liberation of women from patriarchy is an important movement. Gay rights, gay and lesbian liberation, bisexual, transgendered people, an important movement. Class inequity needs to be addressed. All the foreign policy, environmental issues, all of that. But I would suggest to you that all of those also need to be grounded in an understanding of racism, because they affect those issues and they definitely affect our ability to build a movement to address those issues. So think of the counter-globalization work that's going on. I won't say anti-globalization because that's not very accurate. Those of us who are sort of countering the corporate globalization are not against globalization. We're very much for the globalization of worker rights and the globalization of better wages, the globalization of environmental standards. So these are not about being against globalization, but counter the current form, as Perini talked about last night. But that work too often is not rooted in a clear anti-racism analysis on many different levels. So I can go to college campuses where a lot of the work is being done against sweatshops, for example, and I can see almost nothing but white students, even in schools where there is a fairly decent number of students of color. Now, why is that? Why is that happening? Well, I would suggest it's very much the same reason that when I was in college doing anti-apartheid work in the 1980s and up through 1990, our movement was almost all white too. And I used to ask the question, why aren't black people involved in this? I was in New Orleans, for God's sake, a black city. Demographically black, culturally black. Now, Tulane, where I went to school, was not very black, but had a pretty good cadre of African-American students. And the city, for God's sake, is a black city. And yet we were a bunch of white folks, thought we had it all together, these real hip little radicals who like getting our names in the paper and getting on television, doing all this good work. And black people weren't showing up at the sit-ins. They weren't the ones going on hunger strike. They weren't the ones willing to get arrested. Gee, I wonder why. Well, you know, getting arrested if you're black in the city of New Orleans is a little different than getting arrested if you're white, middle class, and your parents can bail you out. So here we were trying to be as radical as we could be in terms of our approach, in terms of our militance, in terms of our pose, but our analysis was anything but radical because we were not linking apartheid in South Africa to apartheid in that city. We weren't addressing the interrelationship between the exploitation of black bodies in South Africa and the regular exploitation that was going on down the block, or even better, on our campus, you see. And the same thing can happen now with the globalization, counter-globalization movement against sweatshops in particular, that end of the movement. If we're only talking about the exploitation of labor in Vietnam and Indonesia, Sri Lanka, El Salvador, et cetera, Mexico, and we're not recognizing the linkage of that with the exploitation of the food service workers on the college campuses, those who were cleaning up, the physical plant workers, those who were doing the work in the hotels of this country, those that are doing low-wage labor in sweatshops in this country, if we're not clear about that, we're not going to build a movement that's going to be diverse, let alone anti-racist. Because why would a person of color in New Orleans have come and joined this movement that I was a part of if we're not addressing their everyday reality? Why would they do it? Why would people of color flock to a conference like this or any other if their issues are not prioritized? Why would they do it? Because see, we who are white, we can sort of choose the issues we want to deal with. Okay? And I'm not saying any of the issues that we choose are bad issues. These are all good issues. And they're issues that people of color care about too. But see, the difference is people of color have to deal with racism. They don't have the luxury of saying, I'm not going to deal with that today. I think I'll go and deal with this only. They have to deal with racism as a matter of survival. We can choose to do it, but we can also choose not to. I'm suggesting that if we want to really build a coalition, a movement for justice on any level, we have to prioritize it. We have to make it part of our work just the same way that those who have no choice prioritize it, if we're going to be effective. And so the anti-sweatshop movement needs to include that understanding. We have to be very clear when people talk about the WTO and its undemocratic nature, its undemocratic structure, and the very legitimate concern that here you have an extra governmental body that will be able to invalidate law, and as Perini talked about last night, right, they'll be able to do what? Essentially override the democratic votes of people in the United States who might want, or in Canada or wherever, who might want stronger laws, and it's a very undemocratic thing. It renders your vote irrelevant. Well, that might be new for some of us, but for an awful lot of folks in this country, their votes have long been irrelevant. And they have long known what it means to have democracy not really apply to them. So we might act shocked that our vote won't count anymore. Now, there are a lot of people of color in this country who have been disenfranchised because of the war on drugs, because of the prison industrial complex, been locked up, usually for minor offenses. Now, they can't vote. It didn't take the WTO to strip them of that right. That happened here. So unless we are talking about the undemocratic structures that we have allowed to be perpetuated without the WTO and linking those two things, why would I, as a black person, for example, automatically gravitate to the anti-WTO movement? If you're not talking about the fact that my vote has meant very little for a very long time anyway. Even the rhetoric about 9/11, people keep saying, well, now we know what it's like to be attacked for who we are. This is the rhetoric, and this is mainstream rhetoric. Oh my God, now we know what it's like. Well, some of us always knew what it was like. Black people always knew what that was like since they first got here, right? Native people certainly knew what it was like to be attacked for who they were. People of color generally have known what that's like. Gays and lesbians, bisexuals, transgendered people have known what it is like to be targeted for who they are. It's just those of us in relatively privileged positions who find this to be new. So welcome, you know, to the world. Here we are. But we have to be linking these issues. Environmental activism, same thing. No environmental movement that does not make environmental racism a primary aspect of their analysis is worthy of anybody's support. The idea that we're all in this together is not really true because some of us get hurt by the environmental hazards that exist in this country first. And those people are disproportionately poor, and more than that, they are usually people of color. They're the ones who live in the most polluted areas where the hazardous waste dumps are put, where when some of the middle class white, very liberal, nice folks are able to block a hazardous waste site being in their area, block a solid waste dump being in their area, block a medical hazardous waste disposal site from being put in their area, where do you think they take it? Most of the time, they don't put it on a barge and just float it around. You know, that's happened, but usually they'll find a poor community of color to put it in, and then it's not our problem anymore. At least that's what a lot of folks think, who are nice, liberal, you know, latte sipping, whatever it is they do, folks. So we have to make that linkage. The anti-war movement, clearly, we have to be doing that. As I said, we wouldn't be bombing Ireland if it were Irish, quote-unquote, terrorists who had done this. And even in terms of who is going to be fighting this war, we know that the people who are going to be on the front lines in any ground war are going to be disproportionately persons of color. So if we're going to actually build a coalition against a war, this one or any other, we're going to have to talk about the racism that is involved with that. We're going to have to make that part of our understanding. And we certainly have to do it in regard to reproductive rights organizing. Here's another area where too oftentimes I've seen white pro-choice forces, white reproductive freedom forces, very quickly sort of compromise on key issues that are of importance to women of color, particularly those who are of low income. So you hear a lot of white pro-choice activists who will say, well, we want to fight, you know, for abortion rights and reproductive freedom rights, but, you know, the public financing aspect, we'll just let that go, right? We're not going to push for that because people don't want to have to fund, you know, our reproductive choices. So who does that help? Well, of course, if you're middle class or above and you can afford your own reproductive health care, whether it's abortion, whether it's contraception, whatever it is, that's fine for you. But if you're somebody who is of low and moderate income, and disproportionately in this country that will be women of color, that's not going to cut it. But what do we get rid of first? What do we sacrifice first? The thing that matters most, perhaps, to those who are the most oppressed. And certainly women who want to have children. This has to be part of a reproductive rights movement as well. Those women who want to have children also have to have full support for decent wages, right? Have to have full support for decent education. So any real reproductive freedom movement has to be talking about the other things that impinge upon one's reproductive freedom. It isn't just restrictions on abortion access. It is also restrictions to college education, restrictions to decent wages and decent jobs, because if you don't have those, you can't start a family. That's also a reproductive choice, right? And so reproductive freedom movements have to talk about the assault on welfare mothers. Why? Because what is that about? It's about controlling the reproduction and the labor potential of certain women disproportionately. But yet when I was in Louisiana doing work there against David Duke and others, and Duke had introduced this bill to essentially sterilize welfare recipients with Norplant. He wanted to put Norplant in their arms for, you know, 3 years as a way to prevent them from having more children. Despite the fact that the typical welfare mother had two kids or one kid, not 7, 10, 15, whatever it was he was saying. That was his solution. Now, we lobbied against that, and we tried to enlist the sort of pro-choice movement in Louisiana in that struggle, because this was a clear attempt to control reproduction. I mean, this was an absurd assault on reproductive freedom, very much like the sterilization of black women and Indian women that took place throughout the last century. Hundreds of thousands, probably 100,000 or more, women of color sterilized. In fact, the Nazis, you should know, their sterilization programs, in fact, were modeled on sterilization programs in the state of Indiana and throughout the United States, particularly in Indiana, that existed, you know, even while Hitler was still in jail. The United States had these programs, even before he got out, let alone formed a government. So this assault on reproductive freedom, this Norplant bill, we tried to get the support of white feminist forces who were very good on some issues, but who, frankly, just totally punted on this. And they said, well, now this isn't our focus. We're focusing on, stopping the parental consent law. Okay. Well, as a result, you know, we had to go this alone, and that's unconscionable. And then these same white pro-choice forces wondered why women of color were not flocking to their organization. But again, they were ignoring the issues of fundamental importance and survival for those women. So if we don't link these issues up, we damage our own movements. The labor movement, history has proven that very clearly, that when the labor movement is not imbued with a clear and explicit anti-racist analysis, what happens? The labor movement is then able to be divided by those who will play off one group against another, so that black folks, Asians, Latinos, historically have been used to break strikes. And because the labor movement was not being built on an anti-racist analysis from the beginning, those white workers who were on strike, instead of blaming the bosses who hired the folks to break the strike, blame the folks breaking the strike. Even though it's a deliberate ploy, right, to turn one against the other, and it inevitably works. The populist movement of the late 1800s, same thing, moving strong, doing well, building support as an electoral entity, as a social movement. It was cross-racial. It was very much focused in anti-racism at first, but then became ripped asunder by those who decided to play that race card against people of color to harm them. And that's what it always is. We hear this term, play the race card. It's usually used very cynically by people who think talking about racism is playing the race card. I would suggest to you that really race is not a card. It is the whole deck. And it determines who the dealer is and who gets dealt. And so we need to be clear when we are forming these contingencies around whatever issue, that unless we understand that, unless we make that part of our work, we're not going to build very effective coalitions. And we have to be very clear when we talk to other people. You know, the argument then becomes, and this is where I'm going to close out today, because I think it's a good place to stop. Folks will ask, well, you know, Tim, if the dominant group, if white people, have such advantages, and we do. I mean, in the labor market, you know, the flip side of discrimination is privilege. The flip side of racial profiling of black and brown people is privilege for those of us who don't get profiled. The flip side of housing discrimination is privilege for those of us who don't get redlined. The flip side of, you know, inequity in any of these areas is those of us who were not the targets of the discrimination end up having privilege. That's just an obvious point, or at least it ought to be. But the problem with saying that is it's only half the puzzle, right? Because if, let's say we go out and we do our anti-racism work very effectively and we're able to prove to people that in fact there is this thing called racial privilege, you know, this is a culture that doesn't tell you to give up privileges, right? This is a culture that tells you, hey, if you've got an advantage, you need to exploit that to its fullest potential. So then the question becomes, how do we get people to want to give up these unearned privileges to create equity? This is a very hard thing to do because people have been sold on these things for so long. And I would suggest one way is certainly to talk about the effect on the labor market. I mean, for working class white people, there's no question that racism and discrimination does, you know, lower the general wage base of all working people. That's sort of a traditional Marxist left argument, and it's true to an extent, and we can make that argument, but I would suggest it's not enough. Because if we only do that, if we only go forward and say, you know, you'd be better off, white working person, if you join with your black and brown brothers and sisters to fight for higher wages, well, if that person has been inundated with notions of white supremacy since birth, that's not going to mean anything, because the very reason that that person can't already see that is because of the racism. So you're going to have to do, if you're going to try and build class coalitions, you have to address racism frontally. You can't just sort of do it on the back end or hope that, you know, by talking about common class interests that racism will go away. You have to also talk very clearly about the harm that comes even to white people from a system of privilege. Now, let me explain what I mean. I don't mean relative harm, because in relative terms, those of us who are white have nothing but benefits from this system. But in absolute terms, there are some significant drawbacks. One of those is that you do take your eye off the bigger picture. So in the state of California, what do white folks do? They go to the polls, they eliminate affirmative action with Prop 209, right? And why? You ask them, they say, well, I'm against affirmative action because my kid can't get into Berkeley because they had to give that slot to the Hernandez child. Now, statistically, that wasn't what was happening at Berkeley or UCLA or anywhere else. But putting that aside for a second, what does it mean when a white family comes to that conclusion that they are being harmed by affirmative action, and so they're going to go out and end it? What are they not looking at? What is the harm that comes to them by accepting that analysis? Well, I'll tell you what it is. By focusing on affirmative action, by focusing their anger on people of color, by falling prey to that kind of racist mentality, that divide and conquer mentality, they weren't paying attention to something much more important. And what was that? Well, in the state of California, for 15 years prior to Proposition 209 being passed in 1996, the state of California, not run by black people, not run by Latinos, not run by Asians, but in terms of the legislature, run very much by disproportionately white folks with quite a bit of money, that state had defunded higher education for 15 years, cut the budget for higher ed over 90% as a share of the overall budget. So what did that mean? It meant there wasn't enough money to build enough colleges to accept all the people who were ready and willing to go to college. Only one new four-year school got built in 15 years. So you had this huge increase of college-age students wanting to get a four-year education. Now they're not able to because there are not enough slots, you see. But instead of focusing on that, people were saying, my kid can't get in because the slot has to go to the black kid or the Latino kid, right? Instead of recognizing that we had a system of scarcity in California and all throughout the country that says not everybody's going to college. And we don't care whether you're white, black, Latino, we're not going to fund this. Now, white folks should have been focusing on that, right? Because by taking their eye off of that, by blaming people of color, by falling prey to racism, they had in fact ignored the much bigger problem even for them, right? And of course, it wasn't because California was broke, because in that same period, they built 24 new prisons in the state of California. Had plenty of money now. They'll tell you they were broke. They weren't broke. They built 24 new prisons. And surely, if you don't educate people, you will need to build more of those. So it definitely made sense with a certain kind of logic. But the reality was that the prison building spree of course, fell on whom? Black folks and Latinos, mostly. But see, the blowback effect of that was that the money that was spent on the prisons couldn't be spent on the schools, and that hurt white people too, right? A vast swath of white, working class, middle class, whatever, also were harmed by that. So there is a blowback effect, but there's something bigger than that. Think about these school shootings. You know, I've written about this a lot. I mentioned it earlier today. And I'm starting to develop this analysis that I think makes sense. Let me share it with you briefly, and that is this. If you ever notice, and we talk a lot about the dysfunctionality of poverty. We talk about, you know, the right says what? If there's crime in a poor community of color, for example, they'll say one of two things. The right will say, well, it's either their genes or it's their cultural defect. Now, those of us on the left, we also have an analysis. We say what? Well, it's unemployment, it's poverty, it's a structural thing. Okay, but notice when it's crime or dysfunction or pathology in those communities, everybody has a theory. When it's crime or pathology or dysfunction in the dominant group, we don't even talk about it. We don't, let alone develop a theory. Now see, here's the deal. There are some dysfunctions that are disproportionately in white middle-class communities. What are they? Let me name them for you. Mass murder, serial killing, child sexual molestation, twice as likely among whites as blacks, for example. Alcohol abuse, not just use, but abuse. Alcoholism, drug abuse, not just use, but abuse. Eating disorders, self-mutilation. You know, I'm trying to think there are others as well. But these are some of the ones that are suicide, either criminal or otherwise. All those are dysfunctional behaviors. Some are criminal, some are not. They're all dysfunctional. And they're all disproportionately in white, not just white, not poor whites, but disproportionately those who are middle class or above. Now, why is that? Got to be a reason. If there's a reason for the pathological or dysfunctional behaviors of poor folks, now there's got to be a reason for this other one. But we don't ask the question. Now, what do all those pathologies have in common? What do all those dysfunctional behaviors have in common? Rage killing, you know, child sexual molestation, alcohol abuse, suicide, drug abuse, eating disorder, self-mutilation. All of them, ask any psychologist, they are all about control. Controlling oneself, maybe even controlling others. Now, who would believe that they needed to be in control in a society? I would suggest to you the people most likely to need to control are people who thought they were supposed to be in control. Now, what does this mean? It means that when you have privilege, whether it's economic, whether it's racial, whether it's gender, or especially if it's all three, you develop a certain set of expectations, a certain sense of entitlement. You expect the world to go a particular way, and then you know what? Things happen. And life intervenes, and having been privileged, having had certain advantages, you're not ready for it. So you have to reassert control, either by internalizing it against yourself or by externalizing it against others. You don't see these same pathologies in poor communities or those of color that are oppressed by racism. There are certain dysfunctional behaviors there too, but they're more what we could call survival pathologies. They're not any less problematic, but they come from a very different place. So my question is, if in fact there are these disproportionately dysfunctional behaviors in the most privileged communities, what does that mean? It means that privilege is not only a huge advantage for those who receive it, but it is in the long run harmful. In the long run, it has certain costs. In the long run, if you're not prepared to deal with the world as it is, particularly a changing world that demographically is less and less white every day, a world that is increasingly global, a world where white men are not going to be able to rule the roost forever, and now they realize it, but if you've been set up to believe that everything was going to be, you know, cool in the carpool, so to speak, and then something happens to you, you're not prepared. James Baldwin had a great quote about this. He said, the man, and it could have, he was talking about it in specific gender terms, but he could have talked about it just as the person who has to snatch his or her humanity out of the fires of human oppression on a daily basis, learns something about him or herself that no school or church can ever teach. He learns a sense of his own authenticity. And what he was saying by this is that those of us who are privileged, those of us who were set up in an advantage position by virtue of not having to deal with the worst that life can offer, we are paranoid about the worst that life has to offer. But those who've had to deal with it have to develop coping mechanisms, have to develop skills to overcome. And as a result, this is not to glorify oppression. It is not to romanticize the oppressed. It is to say that those of us who have not had to deal with that do not have the same coping skills, because why would we? We haven't had to develop them. And so then when something happens, we do something completely crazy, right? The reason that, when we talk about the school shootings, people say, well, we need to stop having teasing, you know, we need to stop bullying. Now, that's true. Bullying in school is a terrible thing. I mean, teasing people is awful. But my God, there are people in this country who deal with a lot worse than being teased. You know, people of color deal with racism. They don't take a gun and shoot everybody that moves. Gays and lesbians deal with homophobia and heterosexism. They are not the ones going into their workplace and killing everybody. Women deal with sexism. They are not the ones going in and killing everybody. Poor folks deal with poverty. They are not the ones committing these mass murders. So what is going on? I would suggest to you that there's something dysfunctional about the culture of privilege. And that dysfunction, of course, first plays itself out on those who don't have the privilege, right? Because they're oppressed by the existence of that structure. But that even those of us who receive the relative advantages of it, we pay a price too down the line. We let down our guard because, see, we thought life was going to be all right. We got away from Denver, now we're in Littleton. We got away from San Diego, now we're in Santee. We left Portland, now we're in Springfield. Everything's cool. And then Kip Kinkle enrolls in our school, and now we got all kinds of trouble. And now Klebold and Harris decide they're going to build bombs, and their parents ain't seen them in a week. You know, we let down our guard because we think, and every time one of these things happens, white folks say what? They say, we didn't think this could happen here. Wasn't supposed to happen anywhere, but we didn't think it would happen here. Why not here? Because we have placed not only a racial and class face on dysfunction, but a geographic face on it. So we get out to the suburbs, now we are safe. That's our expectation. We're now entitled to expect safety. And then something happens and we're not prepared for it. So when I came, the first time I was ever in Columbus, I was talking at a community center downtown, and folks were talking about, there was a guy there who does anti-violence training. He's with a program that does some of this non-violent conflict resolution training in schools here in Columbus. And he was talking about how when they go into the urban schools to push these programs, the principals all know this is important stuff. Because, yeah, we know that, you know, socioeconomic conditions are certainly correlated with violence and crime. So we want the programs for sure. We know we need the programs. And so urban schools all around the country have these programs to try and address nonviolent ways to resolve conflict. Now, the same guy goes out to the suburbs of Columbus and talks to mostly white schools, mostly white parents, mostly white administrators and teachers. And they say, oh, yeah, we'll sign on. They do it for 6 months and then, what do you know, they don't have any violence that six-month period, that semester, and the next semester they say, we don't need this anymore. See, once again, letting down their guard, as I'm sure folks in Springfield did, and Littleton did, and Santee did. So the reality here is that in the long run, even the privilege that gives you an advantage can haunt you, can come back to hurt you. And it's not just race, it's also class and gender. I meet men all around the country who, of course, receive huge advantages from sexism in the workforce, huge, you know, workforce premiums in terms of their pay, in terms of their occupation. But what's the downside? The downside to a patriarchal system that sets men up as the primary breadwinners is that those men then, and I see it everywhere I go, suffer from feeling that they don't have the same connection to their family and their children that they'd like to have. And so I meet men who say, you know, I wasn't there when my child did this, that, or the other. I don't have the same time to spend. And men then come to believe that we don't have the same nurturing abilities that women have because our society does not provide us that opportunity. It's so busy giving us economic privilege that we ignore the social and familial cost of our own privilege, right? Heterosexual men in particular receive huge advantages as a result of being quote-unquote straight. But what's the downside? Well, hey, you don't have to, you know, I'm glad there wasn't a riot yesterday here at Ohio State after the ball game. I know it happens from time to time. But let me suggest to you that there's a big downside to heterosexual privilege as well, because those particularly males who feel they have to prove what a man they are in heterosexual terms engage in dysfunctional behaviors, have all these advantages, but what behaviors am I talking about? Bar fights? Dysfunctional. You can get hurt. Trying to sleep with as many women as they can to prove what a man they are, you can die. Or you can become a father long before you wanted to be a father. All of it dysfunctional, all of it stemming from a culture that says, this is what you're supposed to be and this is what being this is about. So whether it is racial privilege, economic privilege, gender privilege, sexual orientation privilege, in the long run, it doesn't only hurt those who don't have it, it also comes back to haunt those of us who do. In absolute terms, it puts us at risk. It makes it harder for us to see the big picture. And I would suggest to you that, as much as anything, is a reason why dominant group members ought to care about this and ought to want to undo it. And if we don't undo it, let me just make it clear, we are guilty of collaborating with it. It doesn't matter that we didn't set the system up. It doesn't matter that we didn't own slaves. It didn't matter that we never discriminated against anybody, because we inherit the legacy of the system as it is. Individually, we also did not create the national debt. But that's not going to resolve the problem and then remove us from having to address it. If you've ever lived with someone that was a slob, and if you're in college, I know you have or you will, because I certainly did, A lot of times that person you live with won't clean up after him or herself, right? They make a big old pot of spaghetti. Don't clean up. That pot sits there in the kitchen. You didn't cook it. But that tomato sauce starts to crust onto the side of the pot. The dishes just sit there. They get all funky day after day after day. And you think to yourself, well, hell, I didn't cook the spaghetti. I don't even like spaghetti. So I'm not going to clean it up. It's not my mess. That's his mess or her mess. Let them do it. I didn't do it. But after a while, you know, if it doesn't get done, the funk gets extreme. And you decide, damn, I just can't live with this anymore. I have to clean it up. I didn't do it, but I just can't live with this funk anymore. The same is true here. Whether you did it, whether you actually perpetrated racism is not the point. You inherit the legacy of it, and you either have to decide to clean up the funk or continue to live in it. And if you continue to live in it, then your children and your grandchildren will be having this same discussion 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years from now. If we had taken care of business 100 years ago, we wouldn't have to be dealing with this. We wouldn't be where we are, but we are here. And so the question is, what do you do with that? There's a difference between guilt and responsibility. The people in the room here are not guilty, but you are responsible. And if you don't do it, then I'm not going to make any differentiation in my mind between you or anyone else and those who did set it up. Because now you know better, right? You know better. And so your excuses are less. So you have a particular obligation. And Baldwin also, I quote James Baldwin a lot, and people, and you know, the reason is, I mean, if you never read Baldwin, you should. He had something to say about everything, and it was almost always right. And so you can go back and you can read things that he wrote 30 and 40 years ago, and they apply to things today. So I would recommend you go and read him, as well as a lot of other folks, but Baldwin in particular. He said this about those who allow injustice to fester. He said, "He who is the author of a crime knows it. He can make no more demands, nor is anything more demanded of him. But he who collaborates with a crime is doomed, bound forever in that unimaginable and yet all too common condition that we weakly refer to as hell. And in that place, and every American walking around must know it, one can never again summon the breath to cry, 'Let my people go.'" Thank you very much. Take care.